Hey there. My name's Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table's a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is an edited version of something that we call the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with the hope that it can be a positive catalyst and encouragement to you in your own explorations. In our experience, exploring what we believe can sometimes be hard work, and we don't think anybody should have to do that alone. We're able to offer this because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond a local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. Let's start with a conundrum. Conundrum. I actually looked it up because I felt like I know that word, but I wanted to make sure, you know, I do this once in a while where I feel like I'm familiar with a word, and then I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not 100%. Conundrum, a confusing and difficult problem or question. So as it turns out, in this case, I was using it correctly. But I'm going to illustrate the conundrum with an event that took place this past week, the eclipse. Now, just for some context, I missed it. I was taking care of a business matter indoors. It took longer than anticipated. I came out. It was over. But some of you, I know, and millions of other folks arranged their day, their week, their sort of lives around it, and they had the experience. And for some people, the experience was pretty significant.
I actually have eclipse glasses from 1979, and those are what I used to look at the sun.
So
from when I was a kid in school,
wouldn't have been able to buy it.
That's probably true. I don't know if anybody else listens to Gavin Crawford's CBC comedy show, the live kind of comedy show. He always comes out and does a little opening couple of lines. Well, this one was some riff about how the Google search results spiked for the question, "Why do my eyes hurt so bad?" this week. Anyway, why do I just see little circles? The New York Times Morning Online Edition, which I subscribe to, had a thing by Elizabeth Diaz. Elizabeth Diaz is that edition of the New York Times faith and spirituality columnist. And she wrote an article entitled Awesome. But the banner headline it was under was Looking Up Together. And in that article, she said this. She said, for a nation, so the USA in this case, for a nation pulled apart by every manner of division, the eclipse offered a moment of unity, however brief. Which I thought was maybe a little ambitious, but also not untrue. For example, in Russellville, Arkansas, about 100 couples gathered to get married under the eclipse. So during the eclipse, fortunately, it was clear. Anyway, here were their vows. This is the quote. I promise to cherish you like this rarest of events, treasuring each moment as if it were a fleeting or shooting star. The galaxies of our dreams, hand in hand, heart to heart, until the end of time. For in my world, you are my sun, my moon, and all my stars. And you can fit that into the eclipse, right? Like, that's not too long. That's kind of, you know, tidy, romantic, ridiculous. Like, any vow that's worth its salt, right? When we make vows, like, we're biting off a lot. I can't quite decide how I feel about that event in particular, but there's a theme in all of this that also points to the conundrum I mentioned. Division is easy to find, and it's not that hard to cause. We could just miscommunication will do the job. We don't even have to have ill intent. Unity, connection, is much trickier, much more challenging. Individuals pulling together in the same direction, that's powerful, but generally speaking, it's not simple. And in some ways, an event like an eclipse is a moment where it can feel as though the cosmos sort of hands us an opportunity to choose that. We still have to enact our choice, of course, but the opportunity sort of felt like it was just hanging right there, you know, in the sky. A bit of an occasion for us as individuals to gather together around a shared interest, a shared experience, a common goal. In this case, to witness or to experience this unusual celestial event together. I'm not really surprised that the spirituality and religion writer got the nod to write about this. There's a unique power, a kind of combination of one-offness and mystery that really grips us about an event like this, right? It's a diamond we can share, you know, in terms of its scarcity. And it's the sort of power, I think, that shows up in identities in general when they're shared. In everyday language, we could say maybe it's having something in common. And not just any old things, but something we regard or experience, and I think this is one of the keys to the power, something we regard or experience as bigger or greater than ourselves. And there's the conundrum, right? Bigger than ourselves isn't all that easy to come by, perhaps especially in a culture that places such a strong emphasis on radical individualism. Greater than ourselves is sort of an intersection of the self and the other and the greater than both. That's a complex intersection, right? But sometimes we find it. Sometimes we experience it. Maybe it's in sharing an eclipse. Maybe it's in a friendship. Maybe it's in a relationship, in family, the kinds of connections where we feel like we would actually seriously consider laying our life down for somebody. I would die for them. You know, that kind of a feeling, right? Maybe it's in a particular shared identity. Religion comes to mind as a category, along with things like nationality or ethnicity or teamness or fandom. I think another place where this sometimes shows up is in facing a challenge together with others, reaching together for a common goal. I heard several short interviews with participants from a large Special Olympics swim meet this past week as well. And the recurring theme was everybody cheers for everybody at this swim meet. It doesn't matter which city you come from, which team you're on. And the show host in this particular case who was conducting the interview summed it all up by saying, no, that's my kind of sports competition, right? Like, it's pretty winsome, right? You know, everybody cheers for everybody. Who wouldn't want to be part of something where everyone is cheering for everyone, where participating is actually the win? You know, like that's powerful, right? That's lovely. I was charmed and drawn by that. It's pretty tempting, at least to me, to characterize those kinds of things that I was just talking about as greater than us as individuals. We might kind of tend to think about those things as categorically good, the sort of significant realms of human experience that can bring out the best in us. But that is optional, isn't it? We can be drawn together as people around destructive values or goals just as readily as around constructive or caring ones. And there's all sorts of complex blends of those in between. We might even feel, when we look around at the sorts of events that sometimes get us, you know, pulling together, that there's more draw in the destructive than there is in the constructive. That's a bit of a grim thought, but it's one that, you know, history and the evening news both offer some high-profile examples of. But here's one of the parts that we might find challenging that doesn't get talked about as much, and that's the part where we get in our own way. It's kind of nice to hand it off, you know, the problem, isn't it? To kind of go, you're the problem, or the environment's the problem, or history's the problem, or taxes are the problem, or inflation, or the, you know, like pick something external, right? There are, of course, all sorts of traditions that teach some version or other of love others as you love yourself. Funny little cartoon about this showed up in my Facebook feed this week. I think somebody that Judy and I actually have in common, and that's how this person ended up in my face. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. But it was a cartoon of a guy, of a cleric, you know, by the collar, sitting on a park bench, and next to him was an otter. And the otter was talking to him and saying, no, I'm pretty sure it's do unto otters as you would have them do unto you. Thank you, here all week. Which it's actually pretty funny, right? Yeah. You know, I thought. Anyway, so there's lots of traditions, apparently including otters, who have this idea as part of their tradition. Every major religion that we're aware of, and many systems of thought, belief, ethics that we don't think of or name as religions, have come to the conclusion that this love others as you love yourself is the very best way to move forward together as a species. This is the largest single common denominator as a system of ethic, a common shared system of ethic. It's pervasive in some version or other. Predates Christianity and Islam by like 4,000 years and a millennium, respectively. So Confucius is the first documented sort of exponent of this. Here's an oversimplification, but by way of contrast and consideration of the power of this idea, if we love others as we love ourselves, what does that tell us about our mistreatment of others? as a reflection of some aspect of how we feel about ourselves as well. Is hatred of others, to take what might be an extreme example, an outworking of self-hatred, of self-loathing? Probably not exclusively, but also, yes, often, right? So even if we back away from that extremity, I think we're still left with the question, something like, why is love myself sometimes so hard to do? Because sometimes it is, right? Because if love of others depends on love of self, and, you know, the aphorisms, the sayings, the traditions, the teachings, pin them together pretty snugly. If love of others depends on love of self and we can't love ourselves, we're kind of stuck in the driveway, you know? Like, we're a little bit stranded before we get underway, right? Here's a little bit of insight from a person who's thought about this quite a lot. Historian Karen Armstrong. Karen Armstrong, we might be familiar with, I mean, best-selling author, right? But somebody whose personal backstory not everybody knows. Armstrong set out to be a nun, joined a convent and augured right in. Took her, I think, 7 years to come to the conclusion that she was, in her words, an utter failure as a nun. I'm not sure what all the nuances of that are, but it really didn't work. And sort of disavowed religion and became an historian and began to sort of unfold the same some of the same values that took her into being a nun, being in a religious order, as an historian, and ended up being no small authority on compassion, which she discovered through her work was the common denominator in all these things she was studying. So she's dug into this lots. So she thinks that one of the keys to unlocking this dilemma of, if we don't love ourselves, how can we love others? She thinks one of the keys to unlocking that dilemma is compassion. And we talked about compassion this last week, and in particular in our discussion about how powerful curiosity is and its ability to keep us practicing compassion, even when people might not appear to welcome it or be looking for it. So Armstrong suggests that it might be important to turn the lens the other way, right, on ourselves. And for those of you that were part of the conversation last week, you might find it interesting to note, and I'll read the quote here in a moment, but that Armstrong in her work brings together altruism, compassion, and self-awareness. And we kind of separated them from one another in our conversation last week, but she pulls them together this way, which I think is quite interesting. She says this: compassion is aptly summed up in the golden rule, and then listen for the twist here, which asks us to look into our own hearts, discover what gives us pain, and then refuse under any circumstances whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. Compassion can be defined, therefore, as an attitude of principled, consistent altruism. So that's where she brings altruism into her definition of compassion. For those of you who weren't here last week, the definition of altruism that we were working with was the kind or selfish behavior or action often prompted by feelings of compassion. So we distinguished compassion from altruism because you can act in an altruistic manner motivated by things other than compassion. So they're distinguishable in that way. So that's how she brings them together. Now, if we include ourselves in that rule, as Armstrong articulates it, it means that when we look into our own hearts and discover what gives us pain, the first stop in the journey of compassion is to figure out how we can stop causing ourselves pain. So that's what's accessible to us, right? Others can cause us pain as well, but we don't necessarily have control in that regard. The ways in which we cause ourselves pain, that we have, sometimes we need help with it, but that we have access to, at least potentially, right? So we start there. Figure out how we can stop causing ourselves pain, which is another way of saying love ourselves, and then move on to refusing to cause pain to anybody else. But it starts at home. In some ways, I feel like this matter of loving ourselves can easily fall prey to, you know, self-care aphorisms of the fits into a tweet variety. I mean, self-compassion is complex. It's not easy. It takes practice. It's not a switch. It is not, for example, the same thing as you do you at all. Now, not to say there's not value in that notion, but it is not the same thing as self-compassion. And often as not, if we find loving ourselves challenging, it's because we have, as part of our story, lived experiences that have deep and sometimes chronologically distant roots. Bell Hooks, in her book All About Love, which I've referenced a number of times sort of in this these last explorations about around that topic, Hooks suggests that we often have trouble loving ourselves because at some point in our lives we were socialized to see ourselves as unlovable by forces that were outside of our control. And then she goes on to note, and this is interesting, this is a recurring theme in her work, we are not born knowing how to love anyone. Stay with me. Either ourselves or somebody else. But we are born able to respond to care. And as we grow, we can give and receive things like attention, affection, and joy. In other words, we can learn how to love ourselves and subsequently others. But that process of learning to love ourselves and others has a lot to do with our environment, where we are formed. So, interesting take on the human person, right? We don't arrive this way, she argues. We arrive with a capacity that can take us there, but not with that thing fully formed. That feels to me like initially I bridle at that idea in some regards. And yet, when I think about my own lived experience, or I think about so many stories, and I think about the recurring dilemma of how is it that the same species can do things that are both so wonderfully loving and so absolutely atrocious. This idea speaks to that in a way that feels like it could make sense of that to some degree. So I find it helpful. Loving ourselves and others, if we build on that, is not a skill set that we can acquire in isolation. It's a lifelong practice of learning how to combine things like trust and commitment, care, respect, knowledge, responsibility, right? It's a stew. It's got a whole bunch of components mixed together. And as we learn how to blend those things and turn them into actions, our definition of love that we've been working with throughout the series, right, has to do with extending ourselves on our behalf and others' behalf in terms of their spiritual well-being and growth. As we learn how to blend those things and turn them into actions, we also begin to learn how to extend them to ourselves. In other words, we can learn how to show compassion to ourselves, and building on that, we can learn how to show it to others. And the notion that we learn to show ourselves compassion by receiving care from others really turns this whole thing into a circle. That, again, oversimplification, but if it makes it more memorable, something like this. I learn compassion from those who care for me. I learn in that process how to have compassion for myself. I then learn how to extend it to others, providing them with the opportunity to learn it from me, and so on, right? It goes around. And when it's laid out like that, I find it a little bit easier to see why the, you know, well, just love yourself advice is more likely to produce confusion and frustration than progress. Because you can't just do that. Once again, it turns out that we need one another to grow a robust and healthy self, as well as a thriving society. So the misunderstanding of that process is one of the things that can get in the way. Another one is that many of us have grown up in a society that teaches us to be very harsh critics of ourselves. And I mean society both writ large and, you know, closer to home. Interesting in the writ large sense, at least in, this is a U.S. study, but there's been a measurable explosion of this in North America in the past 20 years or so. And in the practice of psychology, one of the ways that that discipline measures this is by measuring the prevalence of perfectionism. And just to be clear about our definitions again, perfectionism is not about being the best at something. It's actually quite different than that by definition. Using Sun, she's a psychologist in Seattle, she defines perfectionism this way. She defines it as the feeling of never arriving to that place, never feeling good enough, never feeling adequate. That's perfectionism. It's not actually about getting it all right. It's about feeling like you never can get it all right. It's almost the working opposite of actually being perfect, whatever that is. So in any case, this is so pervasive within that discipline's practice that there's a test to measure it. It's called the Multidimensional Perfectionism Scale, a descriptive name. And a particular note in that research is the way that that test shows rates of perfectionism just skyrocketing among college students between 2006 and 2022. Just like, the graph just looks like this. It just rockets up. And the steepest rise inside of that tool has been a type of perfectionism called socially prescribed perfectionism, which is rooted in the belief that others expect you to be perfect. I found that quite intriguing. A little distressing as well, but intriguing. So there could be lots of reasons for a result like that, right? I mean, the range could be everything from increasing parental expectations to the pervasiveness of, you know, social media influences or advertising the curated life coming at us as though it were normal. But the upshot of this feeling of not being good enough, of the feeling, is this feeling of not being good enough, of this feeling that our current life circumstances are not adequate or they're not sufficient. I mean, Rockefeller does come to mind on this as a generational wealthy figure who was once asked how much is enough, and he said, just a little bit more. It's that sort of spirit, right? But in terms of our personal performance, if you will, in the world. To live in that space puts us squarely on what one of my early mentors liked to call the more better treadmill. We were working together at that point when I heard him use that phrase. Both A-type individuals, pretty driven, and we needed to remind one another to not get on that treadmill, you know? We'd do something and it would go well, and we'd just be sitting there making lists of how to make it better. That is a soul-sucking place where we never seem to be able to enjoy our successes and where we're usually swimming in self-criticism. That's a pretty hard space in which to practice self-compassion, never mind other compassion. And there are practical strategies we can use to help us with this, of course. I'm not going to get into that today, except to say that those strategies, as I've examined them briefly, seem to have something in common, which is that they are pragmatic, practicable ways of getting our eyes off ourself. Now, we're talking about self-compassion, looking inward before we look outward. But the strategies for not getting stuck in perfectionism have to do with looking outward. In some ways, it brings us full circle back to our earlier conundrum. In order to love others, ancient wisdom teaches us, we need to learn to love ourselves. In order to love ourselves, we need to get our eyes off ourselves and onto something bigger than us. Something bigger than an isolated, it's all about me version of individualism. In other words, to nurture ourselves, we need to begin to understand ourselves as part of something larger. If we think that self-compassion is an isolated activity, we've already missed the key that unlocks the whole thing. Self-compassion is not something we can learn in isolation. Back to Bell Hooks' idea, we don't arrive with this capacity. We learn it, but we don't learn it alone. We learn it socially. We learn it environmentally. We learn it from others. Others don't learn it in isolation either. If love others as you love yourself has some truth to it, then as we learn to love ourselves, we are meant to extend that outward so that others can also learn to love themselves and subsequently others and others and others, right? Once again, in terms of the big shapes of ideas, Western linearity lets us down. And ideas that look at the world as a circle, at life as a circle, speak to us with more eloquence. The Egyptians let us down. This isn't a pyramid with self-actualization at the top, as useful as Maslow's hierarchy of needs might be in informing our imagination about other things. In the end, we need one another, right? And others need us. I want to leave us with two ideas today. First is a metaphor for freeing ourselves from perfectionism, which I found quite interesting. And the motivation, of course, is we want to free ourselves from perfectionism so that we can begin to practice compassion at home with ourselves so that we can offer it to others. So the motivational component of this is one of the things that can keep us from turning back into self-absorption, right? Why are we doing this? So that all may be well. Not so that I can be an isolated, self-loving individual. That's not the goal. If we have that as the goal, the process is going to fail. So that motivational component's important. So back to Dr. Sun, whose definition of perfectionism I mentioned earlier. She suggests that perfectionism is a survival strategy. Again, sort of a classic positive psychology approach in lots of ways, right? I'm drawn to these. I know they're not the whole story, but I do often find them helpful. So she suggests that perfectionism is like an armor that we put on to feel less vulnerable. So it's a way of protecting ourselves from those expectations in ourselves. We get to take them on ourselves. So we kind of take it on so we can manage it. We have some sense of control about it. So it's important to acknowledge that because, among other things, that can help us not beat ourselves up if we're struggling with this. It's an attempt to survive, and one could hardly be blamed for wanting or needing to survive. Here's the but. Sometimes the armor of perfectionism, if we're using it to protect ourselves, can start to weigh us down. So the metaphor is that it's armor, right? So if you're a gamer or not, you just ever walked through a museum where there was a suit of armor, imagine that, all those bits that you put on over that pink vulnerable self, right? That body that can get hurt in so many ways to protect it. She says it has a function. There is a protective function, but sometimes that armor starts to weigh us down. And when that happens, when we start to have that experience, when our perfectionism is getting in the way of us loving ourselves so that we may love others, then it's time, in her words, to thank perfectionism for its service and move on. Which I really quite like, right? It's not the denigration of that experience. It's not that we have to beat ourselves up about having had that experience or having that experience. It's just like, well, maybe that's what I needed then. And now, not so much. And in that metaphor, she's like, it's not about sort of going, oh, no more armor, pwang, you know, like a game show moment where it all flies off and there you are and something else. It's like piece by piece. What are the arm pieces are called greaves, right? Aren't they? Any armor nerds in the room? Any gamers know this? Anyway, I think so. I think that's what, so she's like, start with those, you know? Like, take that piece off first, whatever it is, piece at a time. Then maybe move on to the shin guards. And then, you know, so it's a process, right? The goal of that process is to build an internal rather than an external sense of safety. So instead of having to have a shell on that protects us, our sense of safety is something we carry with us as part of our sense of self, so that one day we can say something to ourselves like, I accept the way I am today versus the way I am supposed to be. Supposed to be is the armor. The way I am is the internalized sense of safety. In other words, I learn how to have compassion for myself. And then from that place of growth, we can turn toward others. I'm going to leave us with that and a quote from a 2009 document called The Charter of Compassion. Did you know there was one of those? I didn't. This week, I learned about the Charter of Compassion. So this is a quote from that charter. Listen to this. It's a pretty good summary, I think. Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody, without exception, with absolute justice, equity, and respect. It is also necessary in both public and private life to refrain consistently and empathetically from inflicting pain. To act or speak violently out of spite, chauvinism, or self-interest, to impoverish, exploit, or deny basic rights to anybody, and to incite hatred by denigrating others, even our enemies, is a denial of our common humanity. That's not so different from love one another as you love yourself now, is it? Whether we ground that value of common humanity in any number of narratives, and this is where religion comes in, right? For such a long time in the Western world, the Christian view of the human person was predominant. And so from that vantage point, we might ground this notion that all humans have value in a narrative that says that we have a common source, right? So that's how that narrative speaks to that. One God, humans all made in that image of that God, all humans have value. So that's how that narrative in particular speaks to that question. If you listen to the news cycle this week, Wob Kanu, right, and he's up to his eyebrows in a fascinating dilemma with, let's change the opening statement for Parliament. Very interesting conversation. I think until that whole conversation gets flipped upside down, they're not going to make a lot of progress. Because if you're trying to tune up the Christian prayer, you're not going to change very much except take out some these and thous. You still have a particular narrative driving the whole idea. So I don't know if anybody else listened to that or read the content of that actual prayer as part of listening to the news this week. It's fascinating. It's like a 1930s Christian, full-on Christian prayer. Although I did hear a Christian pastor with whom I'm well acquainted argue that it wasn't a Christian prayer essentially because it didn't mention Jesus. But in its structure, it's that narrative, right? So fair enough.
I saw someone in the news talk about that, and they're saying, okay, they want to keep this prayer. But then at the same time, they still want to insult each other during the question period.
So it's an excellent way to think about that in lots of ways, Andreas. So that's what I'm talking about, flipping the dialogue upside down and saying what sort of view of held in common is actually big enough to embrace lots of different narratives that ground that in different storylines, right? So the Christian storyline grounds it in a particular place. The Hebrew storyline on which the Christian stands grounds it in a similar place. They're related, like Christianity kind of co-opted Genesis as part of its story. So that's a shared storyline there about why do all humans have value. There might be other reasons why we believe all humans have value, right? There's lots of ways we could ground that. So until we start to go, there's lots of ways to ground this, but the grounding thing that we share is the value of humanity. We're not going to find a way to solve Wab Kanu's problem, among other things, because that we need to get down there. So when I read this, what I just read from the Charter of Compassion, and I say that's not so different from love one another as you love yourself, the teaching of Jesus about this, that's what I'm talking about. That the big idea needs to be big enough to include all those other conclusions that different traditions have come to about that same value. Then we make some progress on this, because now we have a big enough thing in common that we can both use it to inform the way we care about ourselves, I have value, and the way we care about one another, and so do you. Does that make sense? Even if it doesn't, you can go home and think about it. Peace, everybody.